Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. This is actually the last Thursday before Thanksgiving, so of course I want to share with you one of my favorite Thanksgiving recipes that you can make this year, especially if you're doing a turkey-less Thanksgiving. But even if you're doing a turkey Thanksgiving, this is a great main course that can accompany the turkey at the table for any of those people that don't eat turkey, and for all those that do. It's a great side dish. So anyway, I'll be sharing my stuffed heirloom pumpkin recipe with you in just a little bit. But first, I want to go over some things going on in the news, some events coming up, and introduce my guest to you, who will be Eric Holt Jimenez, who is the executive director of Food First and author of A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. And I'll invite him on and tell you more about him in just a little bit. So to get started, I guess right now, while we are here doing the radio show, the House of Representatives are meeting to vote on this horrendous tax bill. This GOP tax bill is just horrible. It has cuts in there for all of the safety net programs that so many people rely on for their food and their health care. It also has a horrible provision that will tax graduate students. Right now, many graduate students going for their PhDs benefit from getting fellowships from the universities where they're studying, which means that they get tuition-free in exchange of doing some teaching or whatever. Anyway, this new tax bill actually makes them have to count that scholarship or fellowship money as income, and they're going to get taxed on it. And I was listening to a great NPR discussion about this, and, you know, the outcome of this could be less people going for their PhDs, which really would have a horrible outcome. Studies after studies have talked about the U.S. needs to really up our ante on in education. We need more people going for higher education because so many of the job requirements these days are not just undergraduate degrees. Undergraduate degrees these days are almost like a high school diploma was years ago. Now people really need a master's or a doctorate to, you know, really move up in their career. And this tax bill is just horrible. And so I don't know if it's too late, but if at all possible, you still can try calling your representatives. The Capitol switchboard is 202-225-3121. It would be great if we all just bombard the Capitol switchboard right now and tell them to vote no on the House tax bill, H.R. 1. It's just, it's horrible. And, you know, if the vote does go along party lines, chances are it's going to pass. So let's just hope and do what we can. Make those calls if you can. It's just really bad news. Okay, lots of things going on in the city and around the area. Tomorrow evening, November 17th, Back to Earth Community Dinner is happening with local farmers up at Fordham University at the Campbell Commons. And this is join Food Impact Investing Practicum and Fordham Social Innovation Collaboratory for a dinner and evening of discussion on sustainable local food systems. The community dinner will feature guest farmers speaking about how they came into their line of work, the obstacles they face, and hopes for the future. And it's a free dinner up at Fordham University. So check that out. All of these events, by the way, are registered on my website, so you can find links from my website, or you can just go directly to their websites. November 18th, there's a rally out in Long Beach on the boardwalk to urge Governor Cuomo to stop allowing the pipelines that transport the polluted gas and oil that comes from fracking. You know, study after study has shown that any climate advances that fracking maybe showed initially is negated because of the leaking of the methane gas. You know, the methane is far worse for global warming than CO2, and almost three times or four times as bad. And any climate benefits that fracking might have had is negated because of this. So there's just so many things. And then there's also, I was listening to NPR yesterday, and they're talking about all of the toxic chemicals that are in the fracked water in communities where they allow fracking, and how many people are getting sick. It's just bad, bad, bad. We need to invest in renewable energy. On November 29th, there's actually a huge rally down at the Manhattan Borough's office. They're going to be voting on climate change issues, and there's a big push from the people from Sandy 5 and other organizations to get New York City to divest their pension funds from oil and gas. Many cities have done this. There's been a big push for years now from 350.org to get universities and medical schools and stuff to divest from fossil fuels. And we need to get New York City to be a leader in that as well. They talk about climate change, but they need to walk the walk. So on November 29th, starting at 8:30 in the morning, there's going to be a big rally down there. I hope some of you can join. Starting this Saturday, I Eat Green will be starting to cook for our big Thanksgiving feast for the less fortunate. This is my 23rd year cooking in partnership with the River Fund Food Pantry. And what we do is we gather donated turkeys and lots of food that's donated from within the community. We do a huge coat collection, including blankets and towels, and we're still looking for those. If you have any coats cleaning out your closet, please drop them off at the IE Green Homestead in Old Westbury. But this is a big event where we cook a full Thanksgiving feast for about 1,000 people. We usually get 700 to 800 people that wait online in Rufus King Park in Jamaica, Queens, for their free Thanksgiving meal. The River Fund brings their mobile food pantry there as well, so they're handing out turkeys to those that actually have a place to cook, and they're handing out lots of food, and you can get some of the coats that we're bringing down. So that's a really big, big event, and there's a sign-up that you can sign up for shifts on my website if you would like to volunteer. So I have hundreds of people that come through my place all weekend, and it is a huge event. And we cook starting tomorrow. No, actually, tomorrow I start shopping. Saturday we start cooking. We're cooking Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and we serve the folks on Tuesday. And all the leftover food, there's always enough food for another couple hundred people. That gets brought to some of the local shelters. So a great event. We'd love to have you join us. If you're interested, check it out on my website. On November 20th, there is an ongoing series that is moderated by Mark Bittman up at Columbia in the Vagelos Education Center. And this is a free event, but you do need to RSVP. This next Monday, Tom Colicchio, who's the co-founder and board member of Food Policy Action, a celebrity chef, founder of the Crafted Hospitality Group, and he will be on the panel along with Paula Daniels, who is the founder of the Los Angeles Food Policy Council, Kathleen Finlay, who's the president of Glenwood. Anyway, they're going to be on a panel moderated by Mark Bittman, and these are great events. I went to one a couple of weeks ago and talked to you about it on food justice issues, and they're really wonderful, and they are free. So if you're interested in food policy, that's where you want to be next Monday, unless you're here volunteering with me. November 28th through the 30th, BioNutrient is having their 7th Annual Soil and Nutrition Conference. That's up in Massachusetts at the Southbridge Hotel in Southbridge, Massachusetts. And early bird registration is over, but there's still room. So if you're interested in soil science, which is everyone should be interested in soil science, check that out. And I'm sure many of you heard last Monday, unfortunately, the National Organic Standards Board voted to allow hydroponics to slide in under the organic labeling law. Very, very sad day for organic farmers and for those of us that really want to be able to trust the organic label. The organic label is the only thing that we really can depend on to keep us safe from genetically modified foods and foods with hormones, antibiotics, pesticides, herbicides, and all that horrible stuff. And hydroponics, granted it does not have pesticides and herbicides sprayed on it, but it does not have any of the nutrients that one gets out of the soil. The liquid nutrients that they are fed is proprietary information, so we don't even know, for the most part, what that is that they're being fed. And it's just not organic. It's certainly better than conventional agriculture, and so why not label it hydroponics? You know, the hydroponic people say it's just as good as organic, and they're pushing for an organic label, but if it's just as good or better, let them have their own label and go promote it. But that's not what happened. It slid under the approval, and there's lots of rallies around that and hoping to reverse it or add on to the true organic label, say organic grown in soil or something like that, so that people know the difference. Again, people have a right for transparency. We have a right to make our choices. And, you know, we can't do that if we don't have the information. Also on November 29th, there's a rally and public hearing. Oh, that's what I just talked about divesting from fossil fuels. And on November 30th, there's a summit up at Hunter College called Food as Medicine Summit. This is also a free event, an all-day event at the Siberman School at Hunter College. And great, great people will be there. Robert Graham, who is a doctor who's been on my show before, who was trained up at Harvard and, you know, a while ago realized that food was really the key to good medicine and good health. He's actually in a program at the Natural Institute Cooking School, the Natural Gourmet Institute. He's training to become a chef now, so he really knows what he's talking about as he teaches other doctors how to cook. He'll be there. Michelle Nishan will be there, who's the CEO of Wholesome Wave, also been a guest on my show, amazing guy. Stephen Ritz, who's been on my show, amazing guy, CEO of Queen Bronx Machine, an unbelievable teacher in the South Bronx. He'll be there. Anyway, it's going to be a wonderful day. I plan on going, and I hope to see many of you there. Lots more on my website. Check it out. I don't want to take the time to go over it now because I do want to share with you my recipe and introduce my guest to you. So Thanksgiving is around the corner next Thursday, so we will not have a show next Thursday. So I wanted to share this with you now. This is a stuffed heirloom pumpkin. I've been growing Long Island cheese pumpkins in my garden, and they're really big, sweet pumpkins that are not orange in color, more gray in color, and I've been stuffing those. And I actually have a video, a little dated video, but it's one that I made years ago, cooking the stuffed pumpkin. So if you want to really see how it's done, you can check out that video on my website as well at ieatgreen.com. But this is a stuffed heirloom pumpkin, and one of the reasons I love making it for Thanksgiving is because of how beautiful it is on the table. It's a really big pumpkin, full-size pumpkin that I stuff. And the same way when people bring a turkey out and you put a turkey on the table and everyone's ooing and eyeing, it's so beautiful, not to me, but to many people. A pumpkin is really, it's just a roasted pumpkin is just a really beautiful centerpiece. So find a really big, beautiful pumpkin. If you can't find an heirloom pumpkin, believe it or not, even one of those big orange pumpkins will do. Just do make sure it's organic. You don't want to use a non-organic pumpkin if you can avoid it. So besides the one large pumpkin that you're going to have, I use seitan in my recipe. I don't have anyone at my table with a gluten allergy. If you do, you can use tofu or tempeh instead because seitan is made from wheat. But I use a pound and a half of seitan that I cut into chunks, and there's many different brands that you can buy there or you can make your own. I have a recipe on my website for making seitan as well. One onion chopped, 4 carrots cut into wedges, 1 pound mushrooms sliced or quartered. You can use a mixture, shiitakes, portobellos, baby bellos, whatever you'd like. 2 yellow squash, 1 butternut squash, 1 sweet potato cut into chunks, 2 red or yellow peppers, 1 head of broccoli cut into florets, 4 parsnips, 1 half small Napa cabbage, 2 baby bok choys, 1/4 cup tamari, 4 cloves garlic, 2 pieces of 2-inch ginger grated, 2 tablespoons of aji marin, 2 tablespoons of tahini mixed with 1 cup of water, 1 package of frozen organic peas, 1 pound of potatoes cut into chunks, 2 sprigs of rosemary, and 2 sprigs of thyme. And I use Napa cabbage and bok choy. If you want to use Swiss chard, collard greens, kale, any greens, you can really substitute what you'd like in here. And that's one of the beauties when you're the chef. You get to put in what you love. So really just put in any vegetables that you love. So you're going to cut a circle out of the top of the pumpkin and scrape out all the seeds. If it's an organic pumpkin, save those seeds and you can plant them in the spring. And then replace the top of the pumpkin and then place the pumpkin in a shallow baking pan. Now, very often, especially if there's a stem on top of the pumpkin, which actually looks really pretty, I turn the lid of the pumpkin upside down so that the stem is inside. Otherwise, it's too tall in the oven. So I place the pumpkin in a shallow baking pan with a little water in the bottom of the pan, and I make a tent with some aluminum foil over the pumpkin to prevent the pumpkin from burning. And I bake it for 1.5 to 2 hours in a 300-degree oven. So it's, you know, not a high temperature because I don't want the pumpkin to get dark. And then meanwhile, while that's cooking, I'm sautéing the onions, the carrots, the butternut squash, the parsnips and potatoes, and the sweet potatoes, all in a stock pot with a little olive oil and, or you can even just do it with a little water. Depends on your preference. But as you can see, those are all the root vegetables which take a little longer to cook. So you're going to give those a head start and cook those for a bit. You can add the garlic and the ginger at this time and just cook that down for 10, 15 minutes, stirring, you know, on occasion so that it's not sticking on the bottom. And you can cover it as well just to let it steam a bit. And you want that to start getting soft. Then you're going to add the broccoli, the mushrooms, the peppers, the yellow squash, the bok choy, and the cabbage, and the herbs, and cook that a bit. You're going to add the tahini and the water, as well as the mirin, the tamari, and the frozen peas. And let that cook for another 10 minutes or so. Then add the seitan, and let that cook for 20 more minutes. And that's just going to turn into a really delicious, aromatic stew, basically. When the pumpkin's ready, you're going to remove the pumpkin from the oven. You're going to fill it with the vegetables, and then you're going to return it to the oven for about 30 minutes to allow the flavors from the vegetables to go into the pumpkin and from the pumpkin to go into the vegetables and let those flavors meld together. And then you're going to serve it right out of the pumpkin. And it's really easy, comes together quickly. And I hope you all make it. It will be a really beautiful centerpiece at your table. So if you do make it, please let me know how it came out, how you like it. I love hearing from all of you, and you can write to me at bhavani@ieatgreen.com. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest. Eric Holt Jimenez is the executive director of Food First, which is a nonprofit organization that works to end the injustices that cause hunger through research, education, and action. And Eric is also an author. He's written, his most recent book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. And as I was saying before, right now with the House of Representatives voting on this new tax cut that will benefit the rich and hurt the middle class and poor, you know, it's just so perfect timing to have him on. He also wrote this other book recently. Actually, he was the editor of this book called Land Justice, Reimagining Land, Food, and the Commons in the United States. And that is another wonderful book. He has written other books, also Food Movements, United Strategies to Transform Our Food Systems. Actually, he edited that book. And he co-authored Food Rebellions, Crisis and the Hunger for Justice with Raj Patel and Annie Shattuck. And he is just amazing and so happy to have him on. Eric, are you with me?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So Let's just start. If you could share with us a little bit about the history of Food First, and then I'd also love to know how you developed your passion for food justice issues and how you got into the food movement.
Sure. Well, Food First was started 42 years ago by an extraordinary woman, which I think many of your listeners...
My hero, yes.
Yeah, Frances Moore LePay, who wrote Diet for a Small Planet, and then with the first royalties from that book, founded this People's Think Tank. And our mission is to end the injustices that cause hunger. And I should say,
I don't know if you know, but Die for a Small Planet was the book that started me on my path. I was 16, and I read that book and haven't eaten a piece of meat since. And it was just, you know, it really opened my eyes to everything that I'm still working on. It's an was an amazing book.
No, likewise. So many people say that. And what the thing is that what Frances Moore LePay discovered over 40 years ago, I think there are two things in that book that really stuck out in my mind. One was that the world produces 1.5 times enough food for every man, woman, and child. So hunger is not due to scarcity. It's due to poverty. People are too poor to buy the food which is being produced. And then the other is that we eat too high on the food chain in the West and causing environmental damage. And then that was true 40 years ago, and unfortunately that's still true today. So the book is still relevant, and Food First is still working on these issues.
Yeah. Change is so slow, but I think, as we'll discuss later, you know, for us that have been in this movement for 40 years, we have seen some change, but it's slow.
Well, we've especially seen change in the movement. I mean, if you think about 40 years ago, there was no food movement. per se, and there were different labor movements, and there was a farm labor movement, and there was, you know, the American agricultural movement, which was dealing with, you know, the crash in prices and people being driven out of farming. And so there were different parts of the puzzle being worked on separately that over the last 40 years have really come together. In an astounding way. And we've seen changes on the ground, and we've seen changes in legislation. And the thing is that as this has happened, the food system itself has also been evolving, responding to other things, other changes, other actors. And that's what my new book is about, which you mentioned, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. And capitalism has been changing over the last half century, and it's certainly affected our food system since, actually, our food system and capitalism co-evolved. And so we can't expect to understand one without understanding the other.
Right. I think as capitalists have seen that food can be profitable, all of a sudden food has become a commodity that's, you know, bought and traded and it's on the market. And you know, it's just, yeah, it's really horrible as greed takes over and, or greed continues. I can't really say it's taking over. It's been there.
No, I mean, the commoditization of food is what allowed capitalism to emerge, quite frankly. And so this has been around for 300 years now. But I think that, we've come to the end of the line with a lot of the aspects of our food system and actually with a lot of aspects of capitalism. So now the question really is, I think, well, we've got to change things. We clearly can't change the food system in isolation from capitalism, you know, the larger political economic system in which it is embedded. So I think it's time to ask ourselves, what type of leverage do we have from within the food system to change everything? And so I think it's a very exciting time.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about a little bit of those leverages?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's true that over the last 20 years or so, we've seen big changes in capitalism. After the great market crash in 1929, Roosevelt introduced reforms into the system because it looked like the country was going to fall. In fact, it looked like capitalism might fall. And those reforms, he started with the food system. He started first with farming to make sure that the farm sector would have parity prices, fair prices for the product, and that they wouldn't overproduce. That was one of the things that brought about the crash in the first place, so to control overproduction. And then Roosevelt also had, in the New Deal, created jobs for people so they could buy the food that was being produced, and had a food program so that any surpluses were then distributed to people in need. And the changes and the reforms to our food system lasted right up and to our economy, lasted right up until Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher started dismantling all of them and calling for what they called was free market policies. Now, it's not free market at all, but it basically meant the dismantling of all regulations and any constraints on the movement of capital or the consolidation of big corporations. And so that's what's been happening around the world and very much in the U.S. And whenever that happens in the history of capitalism, this has happened a number of times before, where you had sort of a bridled capitalism that had social and environmental constraints placed upon the system. And then when you take the bridle off and you just have this unfettered capital, what you get is tremendous concentration of wealth and then tremendous suffering on the part of society and diminished damage to the environment. We were left exposed to unbridled capitalism. And then you get pushback from people who can't take it anymore. And that's called a counter-movement. And the counter-movement is what ushered in the reforms back in the 30s and allowed Roosevelt to actually institute those reforms. They created the political will. And we're seeing the growth of another counter-movement today. And it looks different than before. Before it was led by unions and political parties. And now it's very much led by different actors in civil society. So, the food justice movement and people of color, the ones who are most negatively affected by the food system, are really leading the food movement. And the farm workers, probably the most abused sector of the food system, are also calling for drastic changes to the food system. And we have small organizations, the rise of organic farming. You were mentioning about the certification of hydroponics. That shouldn't be a surprise. That pushback could have been expected because of the commodification of organic food. But we see the tremendous rise of different forms of resistance to the food system as it exists today and to the larger system. And so we're beginning to see alliances between the food justice movement and the climate justice movement, between the food justice movement and the food sovereignty movement, between the food sovereignty movement and the women's movement. And this is the type of convergence that we need in order to build a powerful counter-movement to bring about the changes. And the changes happen at all levels. And I think the changes in some cases are gradual, and in some cases they can be quite violent. I mean, for example, how difficult is it to work on the farm bill? You know, it's almost impossible to get anything done with that farm bill because it's a pillar of late capitalism, and they're not going to let you mess with it. So they have it insulated mm-hmm. by layers and layers of committees so that it's protected from democratic processes. And so that the agribusiness corporations can make sure that they have a bill which is good for them. It's not necessarily so great for farmers, and it certainly isn't that great for consumers, but it's hard for us to get to it. So what do people do? They work at the state level, the county level, the city level, and we've developed a whole wide network of food policy councils around the country that attempt to change the rules You know, the Farm Bill is a big rule for our food system, and not for only in the United States, but around the world. Well, that's too hard to change right now. We don't have enough political power to do that, so people are changing the rules that they can at the local level to make sure that cities and counties are provide incentives for, you know, a different kind of food system and a different kind of agriculture. And that's been growing steadily. And so I think that that's, and consolidating. In California, we just, a couple of years ago, formed the California Food Policy Council. It's really a council of councils, of all the different councils across California. They've been growing over the last 10 years now, have a presence in the state capital, and, you know, we're making a difference. So I think that these types of, these are really political activities which are beginning to go hand in hand with the very practical things which people are doing, you know, the CSAs, the organic farming, urban gardening, you know, all the things that people are doing to try and deal with the myriad of problems that this capitalist food system produces and the externalities which the capitalist food system produces. People are grappling with these problems sort of one by one, often in isolation from each other, but little by little, people are beginning to say, hey, wait a minute, how about if we change the system itself? How about if we change the rules and the institutions? What if we change this corporate food regime for a people's food regime?
Sounds great. Sounds great, but it is, you know, like you said, you know, for someone that's been on the in the food movement for so long and have been a part of it, watching so many of the convergences coming together with, you know, food, the food movement and, as you said, the climate movement and the women's movement, you know, it just gets more powerful that way, and we get louder. I mean, I remember Obama saying, you know, make me do it, you know. I want to hear you make me do it. And, you know, the people's cry has to get louder than the power from the money that these big ag corporations have, because they have
absolutely
the money.
Absolutely. The political cost of not changing, of not introducing reforms, has to be greater than the reward coming from the support of industry. And so, I mean, we really have to embarrass our political leaders into doing the right thing. And
uh-huh.
And we're getting good at that. As the food movement begins to politicize on one hand and converge in all of its diversity on the other, I think that we are going to be able to apply the type of pressure that President Obama was sort of coyly asking for. He was quoting Roosevelt. Roosevelt did the same thing. He would say, that's a great idea. Now get out there and make me do it. He understood that political will comes from two places. It either comes from money, comes from capital, or it comes from the power of people, comes from social movements. And so it really is, the ball is really in our court as a movement to build that power now. And I think that the exciting thing is that the food movement, social movements today, if you look at Black Lives Matter and you look at some of the new farm worker organizations and look at some of the social justice movements around the country and around the world, power is being constructed in a very different way, much more horizontal. Leadership is being constructed in a very different way, much more sort of tactical leadership rather than strategic leadership. The strategy comes from the broad-based movement itself, and leaders carry out that strategy tactically rather than, you know, the sort of the centralized and more hierarchical forms of power that we used to have in our political organizations. So the whole concept of power is changing. You know, we don't have a cookbook for this. We don't have a roadmap for this. This business of converging in our diversity and repoliticizing our organizations has never been done before. We're inventing it as we go along, but I think it's essential. And one of the things we have to do in the food movement, I think, and is beginning to happen, which I think is sort of emblematic for all social movements, is, you know, this convergence would have happened a long time ago if it was easy. It's not easy. It's hard. And it's hard because of the things that divide us. And if we think about the things that divide us, they're cropping up everywhere now. What divides our movement? Well, racism, sexism, classism. You know, these are, we have to dismantle all of these things within society, but we have to dismantle them first within our own movement. And sometimes that means within our own organizations and within ourselves as well. So this is hard work. But I think it's inescapable. I don't think that we can build the type of political power that we need as a food movement unless we face these inequities and injustices and divisions head on and overcome them with love and transparency and, you know, really be fearless about it. And luckily that is beginning to happen. But it's a hard process.
So interesting hearing you talk about this because I went to actually my first time going to a Rise and Resist meeting this week. And, you know, it was an organization that was built after Trump got elected. And when they started, everybody was so angry and there was like hundreds and hundreds of people that would show up at the meetings. And now the meeting, like I said, it was my first time, so I thought there was a good attendance because I'm used to going to my slow food meetings that have really bad attendance. So this looks pretty good to me. And they were talking about how the attendance has gotten bad and how it seems to be because there's inner differences. And they started talking about the inner differences, you know, between, you know, the women or, you know, the gay community or Black Lives Matter or, you know, some of the different issues that are within the own group. And talked exactly what you're saying about we need to work through these personally within our own groups so that we can, you know, really build on the love and go forward with that to heal. Yeah,
absolutely. I think this is the challenge. That means that dismantling racism and sexism and classism in the food movement is not extra work. It is the work. And I think that if the foundations that fund so many of the food justice organizations around the world would see this and provide some resources to actually do this this interior work that we need to do, I think that's just as important and maybe even more important at this moment than, you know, funding a garden, an organic garden in the middle of the city. I mean, we know how to do that. We know how. This isn't a technical problem. It's a political problem, and in general, it's a political problem, and we have to deal with the political problem within our own ranks. So I'm very glad that that organizations like the ones that that you belong to are facing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. Let's take a couple-minute break, Eric, and when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about some of the campaigns and issues that Food Focus is focusing on right now. So,
okay.
Food First. Did I say Food Focus?
Yeah.
Anyway, everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Eric Holt-Dimenes from Food First and author of A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, and we'll be right back.
Stay tuned to PRN.fm for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is Jim Fetzer, the Conspiracy Guy, new program appearing on PRN.fm. I'm delighted to be joining a wonderful collection of hosts to delve into the politically loaded events that the government has been motivated to misrepresent to the American people. The biggies being JFK, 9/11, the death of the plane crash that took the life of Paul Wellstone, but also Sandy Hook Boston bombing. Stand by for more. The show will be Wednesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time.
You're listening to PRN, number one for progressive minds.
everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with Eric Holt-Jimenez. He is the executive director of Food First and author of a wonderful new book called A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. And right before the break, we were talking about how we have to really dismantle some of the things that divide us and really bring us together. And I wanted to talk about some of the issues that Food First is really focusing on head on. Right now, I know you have a project, Eric, you were saying, the Frontline Publishing Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, absolutely, Bhavani. We're very excited about this. Frontline Publishing, you know, Food First's mission is to end the injustices that cause hunger. But we're a think tank. We're a people's think tank. So the way we do that is to produce information and analysis, which is useful for that mission. But over the years, we've worked more and more closely with social movements. It's not that we don't work with experts. We do. And we have a wide net of very capable fellows and academics who help us in our research and publication. But as we've worked more and more closely with movements, and we've tried to be a good neighborhood think tank as well, we've learned a lot. And learned a lot from people on the front lines who are struggling to build a better food system. And who people for whom giving up hope is not an option. No matter how bad things get, they really don't have time to just sit down and give up. They've really got to figure out how to improve their diet, how to have access to healthy food, how to keep from losing their land. You know, the list is long. So we started, actually, with Food Movements Unite to recruit these voices from the front lines. They would write for us and, you know, in chapters and edited books so we could get those voices straight out to the public. And it was actually a very intense but long-term process. It takes a couple of years to put a book out that way. And our last book, edited book, Land Justice, Reimagining Land, Food, and the Commons.
Oh, that's a great book. I went to your launch party this summer.
Book. And, you know, it has this core in it called Black Agrarianism. And we had to work very closely with a collective of African-American food and farm activists who wrote, you know, the three chapters in that book, which I consider to be the backbone of that book. I mean, those chapters are so deep and so powerful and told in a way which is so special. I realized this is what I want to do from now on. We've really got to keep doing this work, but we have the problem of how long it takes. And, you know, most activists are so busy on the front lines confronting the problems in the food system, confronting injustice, and that they don't have time to sit down and write. So it's really like pulling teeth, you know, over the course of 2 years to get them to, you know, let's see that manuscript again. Here are the changes. Can we see that again? You know, all these developmental edits that one goes through to produce a manuscript or a chapter or whatever it might be. So we decided to adopt a different methodology, which actually comes from my past. I worked for 25, 30 years in Latin America with farmers' movements, specifically with the farmer-to-farmer movement, campesino-campesino. And most of those farmers were illiterate, or if they read and wrote, that's really not how they exchanged information. They exchange information, you know, in oral tradition. But they were developing their own sustainable agriculture, agroecology, and the movement is still very strong today. But we had all these methods to work with people who didn't write. And one of them is called Write Shop. And Write Shop is a fascinating process which Food First is now adopting as our methodology for frontline publishing, which is that you bring together the different activists and for an intensive week of writing. And they may come with just, you know, one or two pages of manuscript. But then that is reviewed by everybody, and suggestions are made by everybody. And then each author takes their manuscript and sits down with a professional writer, usually a journalist, and belts out the next draft, and then goes back and presents it to the group and goes through another round of peer review. And this is very comradely peer review because everybody's, you know, writing for the same book and on the same side and writing around the same issue, climate change or gender or the new leadership, or as we just did, you know, land. So you come up with a, a very good manuscript and a very fresh manuscript in a week, which then you just have to copy edit and put together. So rather than putting out a book every 2 years, you know, you can put out a book every 6 months. And I think that's what we need now. We need an intensive process of action, reflection, action, as Paulo Freire used to say, because we have to learn as we go along. We're inventing this as we go along, and we don't have much time. And the challenge is huge because we're not just changing a local food system. We're not just changing the food system. We're changing everything. Why? Because we can't possibly just change a food system and then, you know, live with climate change. No, because climate change is impacting our food systems. And there are many other examples where it's very clear that the change of the structural changes that we need can't be limited to just to the food system. So we really need to intensify the production of what really is, I think, is cutting-edge political thinking and action that's happening within the food movement, and share that as broadly as we can and get the feedback that we can and institute the changes that we need to institute within our strategies and our tactics to move forward.
That's really exciting because you're right. I mean, you know, in everything in our society, we have just gotten so good at isolating, or trying to anyway, isolate things and, you know, and break things apart. And I mean, even, you know, you go to a hand doctor and it's like, no, they don't even do the whole hand. They just specialize in the thumb or, you know, the wrist. You know, I mean, you know, there's not doctors that look at the whole system, your whole body. You know, they break it all apart. And in our society, we're doing that so much in separating everything and isolating everything, you know. And one of the things about farming, you know, it's like, and organic farming especially, is the integrated, you know, how everything's integrated and how everything's connected. And the more we go back to realizing that everything in our society, there's cause and effect, one thing affects the next and they're interrelated, and you can't change one thing in a bubble without seeing the ramifications of something else, you know. And you know, it's just everything. I mean, I was talking to Anna Lappe. She was on a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, talking about the soda tax bill. And I was like, you know, how can we just focus on the sugary soda? What about the diet soda? You know, you take it off, you make it so that the sugar soda is too expensive, so people buy the diet soda. But the diet soda is just as bad, if not worse, for people to drink than the regular soda. You know, why just focus on one? Like, you know, anyway, it's just how everything's connected. And, you know, and we need people that can step back and have the time to reflect, because when you're in it, you just have those blinders on. You're just going for what you're going for, and you can't, you don't have the luxury, like you were saying, of stepping back and trying to look at the whole picture. You know, you're just putting out the fires, and it's really...
And, you know, this is no mistake, Bumani, because over the last 30 years of neoliberal policies, which basically privatize everything and take regulations off everything so that capital can do whatever it wants. And it's also invaded our society and our thinking. And so we've become atomized and fragmented as a society. And, you know, the internet was supposed to bring us together. It may be dividing us just as much as it's bringing us together. And the reason is that basically neoliberalism has destroyed the public sphere. And now, rather than coming together and making decisions on the basis of the common good, we let the market make its decisions for us. And that just means that whoever has the most market power is going to make all the decisions, as we have seen in our food system. And so really, when we talk about constructing a new food system and, you know, converging in our diversity and whatnot, what we're really doing is we are recreating the public sphere. We're recreating that space where, as citizens, as citizens of the planet, we come together and reflect and make rational decisions, so that we don't have a food system which goes against the interests of our communities and the planet. So it's on one hand, this is the difficult task because of the reasons we mentioned about all the divisions which already exist. But on the other hand, when we look around, where else do we see the reconstruction of the public sphere? Not too many places. And mm-hmm. the food movement is one place where this is happening. So I think that's really very encouraging, and we need to keep doing that.
Yeah. You know, and it's interesting because I'm hearing about, the things that are dividing us coming up in, so many different areas. I'm friends with, midwives who are talking about, issues coming up around birth and childbirth and, midwifery. And, that's a whole nother movement that needs to come on board with this movement because, again, they're all connected because, maternal outcomes are connected to poverty too. And, and then that comes right back to it. And, at the Slow Food Nations this summer, I was listening to the keynote speaker talking about, how our whole food system, it was founded, or agriculture, I should say, was founded on the backs of slaves. It was always hard work, and it was always the poor people that were doing that hard work. And, how do we change it from the ground up?
Well, exactly. I have a historical chapter in the book, Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, where I look at the construction of the present food system and how it has always been built on the backs of other people, on exploitation and dispossession and even genocide and in slavery. And there are parts of that which are still, very strong today. Mm-hmm. And so that's why at Food First, we focus on amplifying the voices of those people on the front lines from communities that are most negatively impacted by the present food system and the ones which have historically been exploited by the food system, because that's the leadership that doesn't go away. That's the leadership that doesn't have the luxury of walking away from the struggle. And I think that, some of the other organizations within the food movement who are more privileged, who can afford to vote with their fork, for example, need to keep doing that. I mean, if you can afford to eat in accordance with your values, by all means, continue to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's not enough. You also have to, because you're just acting as a consumer. You're responding to market demand, but we also have to respond to need, which is not the same as demand. And what people need is viable livelihoods, and you won't get that by voting with your fork. We have to turn the food system around to make it a place where people can make a good living. The countryside has to be a good place to live. You look at the countryside of the United States today, particularly the heartland, and it's been devastated and suffering from, an opioid epidemic. The whole society has been hollowed out. No wonder it acts so irrationally and very often votes against what appears to be voting against their own interests and whatnot. It's been devastated. The same with our inner cities. And people are being moved out through gentrification and financialization of properties and whatnot. We have to kind of make alliances with people who are really getting battered right now, because that's where new leadership is evolving, and that's the leadership which is going to take this movement in a powerful direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because those are the people that are passionate about it, because they have to be. You know, when you have the luxury, you have the luxury, so you're not as desperate. So, you know, it's a different type of passion, I guess. But we are just about out of time, and I really had wanted to talk about the sovereignty tours that you have to Cuba. So I think people are going to have to find out about those online. Can you share with us how people would find out about those tours and how to get in touch with you if they would like to?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's a tour in Cuba as we speak. People should go to www.foodfirst.org. So it's just foodfirst.org. And click on the tours. And that's where we have also, you can access all of our materials and learn more about how we work and all of our books. We put out reports and backgrounders, and we're a small team, but we're very prolific, and we have a wide net of fellows who collaborate with us to put out this information and analysis. So that's at foodfirst.org.
Thank you, Eric. You're doing such great work. Really such a pleasure to have you on and to share your knowledge with everyone, and I look forward to our paths crossing again really soon.
I do too, Bhavania. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. And thank you, everyone out there who's been joining us. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Check out my stuffed pumpkin recipe, and I'll see you all in 2 weeks. Have a great Thanksgiving, and bye for now.